Head to the beach in Abercrombie's latest summer drop. New 100% linen shirts are perfect for breezy days by the coast. They're easy to layer and go well with our new sea fade shorts. For days spent on the water, pair the A&F Resort shirt with your favorite swim. Outfit your summer with Abercrombie in the app, online, and in stores.
Hey everyone, welcome to another snack size edition of our show, How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at entrepreneur.com. So we here at the How Success Happens podcast, we being me and super producer Emily, are going to take a weekend off to eat, drink, and hopefully not blow off any fingers while lighting fireworks on the 4th of July. And since by the time this episode drops, we'll have just rung in America's 250th birthday, I thought we could take a listen back to a convo I had with America's storyteller, Ken Burns. So as you know, Ken is quite the filmmaker. His documentaries like The American Revolution, The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz have earned him tons of Emmys and Oscar nominations. Now, I spoke with him a couple of years back while he was promoting the Vietnam War documentary, and he had so many incredible things to say about his process and the art of storytelling and the state of entrepreneurship in America that I thought we'd share some snack-sized highlights right here. So, to kick things off, I asked Ken how he produces such an incredible amount of work and how he answers that huge question, what should I do next?
Sorry to say, in a kind of admission of kind of foolishness, that I'm thinking usually about 13 or 14 films ahead. I'm now working on 6 or 7 at the same time, which is insane. You can do 2 or 3. And I don't mean things that are back burner, but things that are actually planned. And a lot of that has to do with the economies of scale that our labor-intensive historical projects require. The film that I'm finishing on, the Vietnam War, was 10 years, more than 10 years, in the making. And that's from the moment we decide to do it, and then we're in public television, so you're going out to raise the money from a whole variety of very, very kind people like Bank of America or individuals who participate in the Better Angel Society, which is a nonprofit that I help sort of kickstart to raise money from individuals of wealth to foundations to government granting agencies like the National Endowment for the Humanities and Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So you need this long view. And but the actual selection is not based on any kind of market research. It's not based on any kind of sense of, well, this will do well. It's a gut feeling. It's like, it's the chemistry that happens between friends. You got a lot of ideas, 50, 60, 70 film ideas. I mean, if I were given 1,000 years, I wouldn't run out of topics in American history, but maybe there's 50 or 60 things I'm thinking about. And then every once in a while, one drops from your head to your heart, and you go, got to do that one. And then you sort of add that to the queue, and it just becomes finding the bandwidth and figuring out who the collaborators are, which is the number one thing is who the collaborators are.
So given all the time that goes into these projects, I wonder what happens if, let's say, 5 years into research, Ken realizes, man, things aren't really working out.
No, I'm really lucky. For many years, people would say that question, and I would say, well, you know, I've always wanted to do a history of Dr. King, and I know that the family is very controlling, so I assumed that that wouldn't happen. And then just completely coincidentally, the family wrote me a letter saying, we think you are the one person to do the film on our father and husband. And I said, you are right. I am the person. But after a day of talking to them, I realized that that controlling interest, very understandable, a man that belonged to the rest of us, a father and a husband you couldn't control in life, was perhaps controllable in death. And so I very early on walked away from that. But not yet. So I feel comfortable that a lot of it has to do with public television, a lot of it has to do with my stubbornness. And people always say, you know, well, 10 years, don't you get bored? And I go, actually, it's so hard to leave a project that you've been working on for 10 years, that each day it actually gets better and better and better. So it's the opposite of how we operate today. You know, it's the opposite of a quarter model, which is judge me quarter to quarter, a corporate model, I should say, judge me quarter to quarter. It's the opposite of what a intensely focused media now is all about. But it actually works. And I don't live in Los Angeles or New York City. I live in a tiny village in New Hampshire, which permits us to do the deep dives, to do the necessary research, and to keep the sanity in the course of a 10-plus year project.
With so many projects in different stages of development circulating around all the time, I asked Ken how he goes about building a team and leading a team to support all this work.
Film credits show several hundred people, quite correctly, that we are grateful for. But every one of the films is really handmade. And even the big series, you could reduce it to about a dozen or so people. So it's an intimate kind of family project. And we live in New Hampshire for the most part. Some live in New York, but editing is done up there. Some editing is on smaller stuff is done in New York, but it's with my family members. So it is a family affair. It's really important to choose the collaborators, and I've been super lucky. I've worked with the same cinematographer for over 40 years. I've been working with my writer, Jeffrey C. Ward, for, since the early 80s, 82, I think it is. I've been working with a lot of co-producers since 89. So we've got people that I know for really, really well. So, it's hugely important to get your collaborators right and people that you trust. To learn how to delegate, to trust them. And what's nice is that my editors, for example, most of them came as interns and worked their way to apprentice and then become an assistant. And then, after 10 or 15 years are themselves full-fledged editors. And then just based on seniority rise to be the senior editor on a particular project. We have four editors, four assistants, four apprentices, some interns for the country music film, which has 8 episodes. So each of the editors is taking 2 episodes. So a lot of it is good generalship of planning the time. When we finish editing the Vietnam thing, lo and behold, we're ready to begin editing the country music thing. And a lot of the one-off or two-part biographies sort of sneak in here and there with other people. So a lot of it is extraordinarily careful time management. But the biggest thing is this is a gloriously collaborative medium and it's choosing the right people. And I'm thrilled that we're invigorated by young talent all the time, but we've also got a lot of people that I would trust to go and battle with, people I want to spend time in a foxhole with.
Okay, so Ken seems like a nice guy, and he is. From all the interactions I've had with him, he is just really smart, lovely to speak with, obviously super eloquent guy, just a nice guy. But things don't always go the way we want them to go. So I wondered, talking to these longtime collaborators and working with his family, does Ken Burns ever have to go into ball-busting mode when things aren't going the way he wanted them to go?
So everybody screws up, including me. I mean, I have a certain confidence that in the darkest days, I seem to know what to do next. And I do, and I say that. But it's not to say that the next morning that isn't terrible, that it doesn't suck. And I'm the first person to admit that. And if you create that environment, then there's not a question of needing to bust any balls. It's just a question of process. We're all going to try something. And this is not brain surgery. This is not heart surgery. You get to yell if somebody doesn't hand you the right clamp or the right suture, whatever it might be, the right scalpel. But here it's not. We hope to perform a kind of open heart surgery with the results of the film, but there's no yelling. And we don't yell. We have disagreements that can be passionate, but they're never loud and vociferous. They're not personal and angry. And so you get along and you figure it out and you have time to do that and you trust. And so we finish an episode and we look to the interns. What do you think? And we look to the senior editors and what do you think? And the co-producers and what do you think? And visitors, what do you think? And we digest it. And there's always a grain of truth. If you don't listen to it, I know that I have the right to make a decision, the final decision, and I will do that if we're in doubt. But I'd rather reach a consensus before that, before you have to drop that shoe. But even then, people understand that at the end of the day, because of the way we've operated, in this kind of generous spirit of collaboration, that they're going to trust the fact that if I'm going to make that final decision, if it's necessary, that we haven't all come along to it, along with it, then they'll accede.
Next, I ask Ken, which of his film subjects has had the biggest impact on his life?
I don't know anybody that's been a subject of our film that hasn't influenced us in some ways, even in the opposite. You know, we made a film on Frank Lloyd Wright. It won a Peabody Award, which is the highest award you can get. But he's a very disagreeable character. He's a genius. He's obviously the greatest architect in American history, and he would be the first to tell you that. So of all the folks I've made films on, he's the person I'd least like to go into a bar and have a drink with or get in a car and travel across the country with. But yeah, no, almost every film, it might be from the people we work with, like Wynton Marsalis in the Jazz series, who is an incredibly extraordinary human being. It might be, you know, the subjects themselves, the Roosevelts, Theodore Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, who are prime examples of leadership and also deeply flawed people. So you're never doing a kind of black and white study. It's not, you know, we live in a real binary world where everything is a one or a zero. And that we do that at our, you know, if we buy into that, something's lost, because nothing is either black or white. There's always infinite shades of gray, and we are looking for that nuance thing, the place where the hero has flaws and where the villain isn't as bad as we think they are.
Okay, so big question for really anyone who's doing something that they're really passionate about. How do you blend your life and work together in a healthy way?
I don't see the blending. I mean, I make sure that, I mean, I have a lot of colleagues and friends in the business who work all the time, 7 days a week, you know, into the night, you know, on the weekends, and we don't do that. We're like, you know, you come in, and if you can do your work and you're home and you've got family, go and do that. At the same time, we work really hard when we're doing it, and I really, really appreciate the sense of sort of the spirit of collaborative work in that regard. And so there's not set hours, but there's a real work ethic. And I think that, you know, we never end up firing anybody. People just go, this isn't the right fit for me. And we kind of go, yep, under our breath, that wasn't the right fit for us. But it takes almost no time for people to realize that. And even among the interns who come and work at minimum wage for us from various colleges in the area in New Hampshire and even across the country, it becomes clear who's going to make it and who's not going to make it. And that's all right. This isn't for everybody. A lot of people are drawn to film for its apparent glamour and not realize, oh my goodness, it's really hard work, you know? And when you're in production and filming, you're up sometimes at 3 or 3:30 to catch a sunrise and up till 10 to catch the end of that in the summertime. And so, and it requires a certain patience, I think, to realize that story emerges. It doesn't actually, if it's superimposed on the subject, then you can see that it's superficial, it's rote, it reflects conventional wisdom, it has a kind of, you know, superficiality to it that doesn't work. But if you're willing to sort of sit with the subject, it begins like sonar to bounce back at you. And it tells you what it needs, and you realize, oh my goodness, I literally have to understand that everything I thought about Theodore Roosevelt is different, and I need to make room in the film for that kind of understanding.
A lot of people want to do things. We start writing a novel or we start writing a business plan, but not everyone gets to type the words, the end. So I asked Ken what it takes to get to the finish line, especially when you've got such huge endeavors in the works.
Two kind of platitudes or truisms that will sound so cliched and trite that, you know, that I sort of resist even saying them. And they're true not just for what I do, but for any subject, which is you first have to know who you are. There's a kind of ultimate Socratic thing. Who am I? What am I interested in? What's my strength? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Do I have something to say? These are huge existential questions, but they do have practical day-to-day manifestations. And I think you've got to constantly be saying, is this what I'm doing? I mean, I feel very lucky that at age 12, I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker. By 19 or 20, I knew I wanted to be documentary. And by the time I graduated from college, I knew it was history. So that's that's really lucky, and I acknowledge that that's not always the case for other people. But you got to be able to means test yourself constantly in the process. And then it requires perseverance. I'm sure there are a lot of more talented filmmakers than me with really, really good ideas, but just haven't been able to follow through. And as much as these things, know yourself and persevere, are cliches, they nonetheless have become cliches because it's the only way to do that. And that applies to documentary filmmaking, to feature filmmaking, to digging a ditch, to tending a garden, to being a good parent, all of the choices that we make. It's got to be, as Emerson said in his essay on self-reliance, what inly rejoices. A lot of people want to, you know, I'm supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer the way my parents told me to be, and it doesn't work for them. They're not happy in that. But if you do what inly rejoices, as Emerson said, I love that, I-N-L-Y, inly rejoices, it'll be okay.
So big question, obviously, for this audience. How does Ken Burns feel about the state of entrepreneurship in America?
But I think entrepreneurship is at the heart of who we are in terms of the American promise, the American dream. I mean, you really have to go back to fundamentals. For the first time in human history, we decided that we would trust the people to govern themselves. That unleashes all sorts of creative energies. You know, I remember interviewing a writer and historian for my baseball series. He said, when Americans are studied 2,000 or 1,000 years from now, we'll be known for three things: the Constitution, baseball, and jazz music, right? And what all three have in common is that they're improvisatory. The Constitution is the shortest constitution on earth. You know, it's just four pieces of parchment that's able to provide us with this improvisatory space. And of course, baseball has infinite chess-like combinations. And of course, the heart of the music that is recognized as an art form that Americans have created, jazz, is all about improvisation, not playing the notes on the page. And so entrepreneurship is an extension of that or a manifestation of that. And I believe it. And I don't have any idea whether the new tools today make it easier or harder, or new politics restrain liberate. But I do know it's very, very difficult to do that, and that it doesn't have to be always with regard to the bottom line. That what we find, you know, like Andrew Mason can go from Groupon to Detour, you know, with a different kind of spirit, but the same person is engaging it. I'm with public broadcasting, and my model is, you know, with one foot sort of tentatively in the marketplace and the other very proudly out of it. My films are not invested in. I have underwriters, people who are willing, granting agencies and foundations and individuals and corporations that say, yes, we like this idea. We trust you to make a good film of it. And I fill up a bucket with whatever the budget is for the film, and I empty that during the course of it. No profit margin, no contingency. And whatever's done is done. Now, there may be some program income at the end, but we look to sort of reinvest that into the development of new stuff and to keep good people by offering them stuff. But it's wonderful. I mean, I live in rural New Hampshire where it doesn't have the same overhead as I would if I was on, you know, 7th Avenue and 35th Street. But you miss the number of cinema options at any given night, except we all have Hulu and Netflix and Apple TV. And so maybe we have the same.
So Ken became famous for a signature technique used in his films, where the camera slowly moves across a still image, often revealing an incredible detail and just really bringing these images to life. And Steve Jobs was so taken by it, he asked Ken to allow him to name a video editing tool in the Apple ecosystem the Ken Burns Effect. Ken agreed and donated the proceeds from that deal to various charities. And I asked Ken about that agreement and about the friendship that he later developed with Jobs.
You know, at first he thought I had the stupidest model ever. He said, you are not getting a good deal. And he said, I need you to please promise me you'll go talk to my lawyer in Los Angeles, and he should talk to your lawyer, and you could see. And he finally came back, he said, I get it, okay, I'm sorry. And I think there was, in all contact, in all real relationship, there's recognition. That is to say, we don't always recognize the person who's checking us out at the grocery store. We don't always recognize the person who takes our ticket. But in our friendship, we recognize the other. And I think something happened, and I saw in him and he saw in me something. And that's the basis of real communication. And it has to do with, you know, there's only communication if you believe the other person is equal. Another great benefit of a democracy, if you've got huge imbalance or you're filled with oligarchs and then a kind of proletariat that's working all the time, that doesn't work because there's not an equal basis. But in a democracy, supposedly, you have that. And all the things that you could say that are wrong have to do with the disparity between people based on race, based on class, based on all the distinctions that we make in our binary culture.
So we live in a world where basically every second of our lives are being documented with social media posts, our vacations, what we ate for lunch. I asked Ken how he thought future documentarians will look back at this giant pile of digital stuff we're leaving behind, and what he thinks they'll make of it.
There is a tyranny in choice. There are lots of photographs being taken, a lot more photographs than we're going to be taking 50 years ago or 100 years ago. But, you know, when the telegraph came out, people just sort of said, oh, this is a new technology. I don't know what it's going to do to destabilize us, right? So every new technology has that kind of worry attached to it. And yet we use the tools we have. Maybe it will be possible to take the tweets and the photos and the emails of today and fill in the parts of the canvas that we need to do as we tell complicated stories. You know, we'll go to war again, and quite often everybody's mounted with a body camera, you know, which gives you an even more intimate view of it than we had in Vietnam, in which we had to trust that there was a crew there, and if they weren't, then we had to find some generic footage that more or less represented what our soldiers, Marines, and Army guys or pilots were saying and try to fit them together in a kind of honorable, poetic license. But, you know, we may even be able to have it. We feel thrilled in our Vietnam series that we've interviewed a Viet Cong who's looking through the hedgerow at the American advisor, Marine advisor that we've interviewed, and his Vietnamese counterpart in the same battle. So they're looking at each other. And they don't know it, but once you get these three interviews together, you go, oh my goodness, you know? And so I think that's what we're still looking for. It's just like what happens in the Civil War when you go, oh my God, I found a rebel diary of what it was like to be on Little Round Top and a Union diary of what it was like to be on Little Round Top. So all of a sudden I'm on Little Round Top too. And so history is not was, but is, as William Faulkner absolutely correctly said. And that's my job, is to try to make the past present.
And finally, I asked Ken a simple question about how he starts his day. And of course, he used that as a starting point to talk about how we live our lives and the human quest to obtain immortality through storytelling. Did I mention that this guy is really eloquent?
You know what? I have no problem starting my day. Coffee is not in my diet. It's the other way around. I have to figure out how to turn the machine off at the end of the day. That's my biggest problem. It's exciting. There's lots of things to do and there's not enough time. I mean, you know, there's an interesting truth about the human condition is that none of us are getting out of this alive. None of us. There's nobody for whom an exception is going to be made and you're going to live forever. So you could reasonably assume that the human race could be sitting in a fetal position, sucking their thumb all day, but we don't. We create symphonies. We raise children. We build cathedrals. We develop apps. We do all sorts of things that just sort of belie that. And the thing we do most of all is we tell stories to each other. Honey, how is your day? Does not begin, I backed slowly down the driveway, avoiding the garbage can at the curb. But it becomes the editing of human experience into something that we then hand to somebody else, which is called a story. And in the telling of stories, in the making of things, we create a kind of immortality.
All right, so that's my chat with Ken Burns. If you haven't watched The American Revolution yet, do it. I don't want to spoil anything, but let's just say that everything we were taught in grade school might not have been 100% accurate. It's amazing. It is quite long, but it is worth it, I swear to you. Okay, enough from me. Thanks for listening. Subscribe, comment, do all that fun stuff, and hope you had a great 4th. We'll see you next week.
Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.